Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Randall Bomer about his new book, Passion Players: How Religion Shaped Sports in North America. Randall, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I wonder if you could start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm actually a professor. I teach at Dartmouth College. I have been here since 2012. And before that, I taught for 27 years at Columbia University in New York City. And my field is American religious history, so I've been working along those lines for a long time. I published about, I think this book is my 18th book, if I count correctly. And so I've done a great deal of publishing in the world of American religious history. But this book about sports allowed me to kind of step outside my lane a little bit, and I had a great deal of fun writing this book. And in some ways, it certainly draws on my area of research expertise and experience, but in some ways it pushes me in different directions. So I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, you note in the acknowledgement section that this book is a few decades in the making. How did the idea for this book come about, and how did that kind of evolve over time?
I did my graduate work at Princeton University, and I was in the religion department because that's where I was admitted. That's where I was studying. But I took a lot of my courses in the history department. My mentor there was a man named John Murren, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago from COVID. And John was a colonial historian, which is what I was studying with him. But he was also an inveterate sports fan. And when I was playing alongside him and others and with the history department softball team in the summers during my graduate days at Princeton, he would often sort of launch into these monologues about sports and what was the meaning behind the major sports in North America. He would talk about baseball, football, and basketball. He didn't talk about hockey. I don't remember talking about hockey at all, actually. But he got me thinking about this, and as you say, it's really a book that's been 40 years in the making. I've been kind of mulling this over for 40 years. And what John would talk about, for example, would be how baseball is the quintessential immigrant game, because it's the only game where the defense controls the ball and is the object of the offensive player, the batter, to disrupt the defense's control of the ball. And he's outnumbered, that is, the batter is outnumbered 9-1. There are only three islands of safety out there in that hostile world, this hostile territory. And of course, the greatest triumph is to return home, just like the immigrant wants to return home in triumph, saying that he'd been able to make his way in American society. And of course, when baseball was being developed, this was the time of massive immigration into the United States and Canada. And so the game of baseball perfectly embodies the spirit of the immigrant. And it's also true, of course, as you know, that immigrants have always excelled at baseball. So in the 19th century, it would be immigrants from, say, Germany or Italy or Scandinavia. And in more recent years, of course, immigrants are also excelling in baseball. They tend to come from the Caribbean, particularly the Dominican Republic, as well as now more and more players coming from Asia. So that's what got me thinking about this book. And he would talk about football also as a military game, concerned with the conquest and the defense of territory, and basketball as a quintessential urban game. And so this book allowed me to kind of put all these ideas together, add hockey to the mix, and this is what came out of it, Passion Plays.
Yeah, and I love how you start off early on talking about sports talk radio and some of this symbolism in the religious symbolism in that, things I never really thought of. And I was raised, I'm a native New Yorker, so I was, you know, from the time I was a kid, I kind of grew up on Mike and the Mad Dog and WFAN.
Sure.
So I certainly, other shows as well, I certainly related to that. What is some of the religious symbolism that you found in sports talk radio?
Well, what occurred to me about sports talk radio, again, I was at Columbia University at the time, so I was there. I actually remember the transition of WNBC to WFAN in the beginning of sports talk radio in New York City. And first, my first impression, as you know, was just to be utterly befuddled by it. I mean, I couldn't believe that these talk show hosts could sustain these conversations over just the tiniest detail of the game that occurred the night or the day before. You know, should Joe Torre have lifted the starting pitcher with two outs in the bottom of the sixth inning or something like that? And the conversation would go on for hours and hours debating about this, as if the debate could change what happened in the game and the night before. But the more I thought about it, the more it occurred to me that sports talk radio is a kind of confessional. And in those years, as you'll remember, one of the taglines for the callers very often was, hey, Mike, first time, long time, meaning first time caller, long time listener. And it was just kind of a ritual incantation. And then, of course, the caller would go on to talk about whatever was on his mind. And it occurred to me that in some ways it's like a Catholic confessional. That is to say that the penitent, that is the parishioner, goes into the confessional and he says, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 6 months since my last confession or whatever it is. And then the interaction would take place, much like talk radio. But it was also clear to me that the sports host, the talk radio host, whether it's Mike Francesa or Mad Dog Russo or Steve Summers or whoever it might be, that was the authority figure. And so these talk show callers would kind of make their case, would kind of present their argument before the authority, that is the sports radio host. And then the host had the authority either to validate what the caller was saying or to kind of dismiss it, laugh it off, you know, some preposterous trade, I'm trying to imagine something crazy. The Yankees should trade, a utility infielder for Carlton Fisk or something like that, you know, something really, really off the wall. And it seemed to me that the interaction was similar to what might go on in a confessional. So that's one of the things I tried to talk about in the book.
Yeah. I love history and I'm interested in American history. And so I kind of really enjoyed reading about how the changes in American society and culture in the 20th century and the 19th century, I'm sorry, and in Canada as well, kind of paved the way for competitive sports. Can you talk about some of those societal changes that led to these sports that we know and love today?
Sure. Sure. I mean, the big one, of course, was the Industrial Revolution, which really did change not only the economy, but it changed domestic patterns. That is to say that in the days before the Industrial Revolution, men would be working at home or on the farm, providing subsistence living for their families. And then with the advent of the factory system, for example, and later with offices, men are beginning to work outside the home. They're socializing with other workers rather than with their family. They are involved in the factories and the textile mills, for example, early on, or in some sort of sedentary office job. And so as that changes over the course of the 19th century, the games are developing much at the same time. And baseball, again, is a wonderful example because baseball really was developed during the Industrial Revolution. But baseball decides in many ways to be countercultural. That is to say, baseball rejected the icon of industrialism, which is the clock. It's the only major sport that rejected the regulation of time. And when you think about baseball, I talked about it earlier as an immigrant game, and I believe it is. But also with baseball, the runner runs around the bases counterclockwise as though he's trying to subvert the passage of time. And baseball games are notoriously long. And today, in an internet age, of course, that is a problem for those of us who are guardians or consider ourselves guardians of baseball because people are not tuning in any longer. They're not sitting for these long games that have an indeterminate duration. And so that's one of the challenges facing baseball. But baseball remains resolutely anti-modern, anti-industrial. One of the other developments in the 19th century, of course, is the Civil War, in many ways the defining moment in American history. And football comes out of the Civil War. Football was certainly played earlier, what was called football, but football as we know it really was developed in the years after the Civil War. And as we know, the first intercollegiate game, of course, was played in 1869 in New Brunswick, New Jersey, between Princeton and Rutgers. But football was really developed by the sons, brothers, and nephews of Union Army officers at elite Northeastern schools, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, Rutgers, Columbia, eventually Penn and these other schools. And what's striking to me about football is the extent to which football really is a military game. That is to say, football is concerned with the conquest and the defense of territory, just like the Battle of Gettysburg or Antietam or Bull Run or Manassas or wherever it might be. Football also has adopted the language of militarism. Even today, you'll hear announcers talk about the quarterback as the field general who marches his troops down the field. They talk about trench warfare. The quarterback unleashes long bombs or bullet passes. And even language like training camp or scouting, those are all military terms. And in the book, as you know, I quote a lot of 19th century people talking about football as a military game, using the language of war and warfare. And it's also striking to me that as the tactics for warfare have changed over the course of the 20th and now the 21st century, so have the tactics of football. Football used to be a ground game, like tank warfare or trench warfare in World War I. And now, of course, football, at least at the collegiate level and the NFL level, is marked by passing. So it's aerial warfare at the same time that the tactics of the battlefield have shifted to the airways.
I have to ask you, because it couldn't help come to my mind reading your descriptions and kind of comparison of baseball and football. Are you familiar with George Carlin's old routine comparing the two sports?
Yes. Yes.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is, yes. A bunt, right. Yes, yeah. I remember that. Or a sacrifice. Yeah. Yes.
And baseball, everybody wants to go home. They want to be safe at home.
Right, exactly.
I want to touch on this notion of muscular Christianity, because I think that's, you know, as you discuss in the book, is important to the development of sports. And for me, when I think of muscular Christianity, just thinking of that term, Teddy Roosevelt kind of pops into mind for me. But so where did that idea of muscular Christianity come from, and how is it a departure from previous views within Christianity?
Yeah, there was a lot of concern in the 19th century, again, with the Industrial Revolution. And the concern actually originated in Britain and then came across the Atlantic. Churchmen were afraid that, first of all, men were not showing up in church. Women were really taking over the life of the church. And this was true both in Britain and in North America. And they were also concerned that men were not getting enough exercise. They were working in these sedentary office jobs, or they were working in the factory, not getting enough fresh air, not getting enough exercise, and were becoming almost effeminate. And that was one of the concerns. And so these churchmen, who at that time were Protestant, began to devise what they called muscular Christianity, which emphasized that the New Testament emphases on both militarism and athleticism. If you read in the New Testament, for example, St. Paul talks about putting on the full armor of God and doing battle against the devil. Paul talks about finishing the course, running the race. Those are military metaphors and athletic metaphors. And so muscular Christianity combined all of that and began to valorize these athletic, muscular Christians. And probably the best institutional example of that would be, of course, the Young Men's Christian Association, or the YMCA, which catered to young men coming into the cities during the Industrial Revolution and tried to provide for them a place of refuge. And, of course, recreation was very much part of that. And then the direct consequence of that was the invention of the game of basketball by an instructor at the YMCA training school, now known as Springfield College in Springfield, Massachusetts. And the idea, once again, was to provide recreation for young men during or between the football and the baseball seasons. So that would be probably the best example of muscular Christianity. But this theme has remained very much prominent in Christian circles. The Catholics picked up on it, for example, with the CYO, the Catholic Youth Organization, with basketball leagues and boxing tournaments and that sort of thing. And probably the most obvious recent example of muscular Christianity would be the Promise Keepers movement of the 1990s that was really begun by a football coach at the University of Colorado who decided to gather men into stadiums and try to encourage them to be manly Christians, to be people of faith. So this muscular Christianity movement is sort of in the background in all of these four major team sports, but it's especially important in the development of basketball.
Right. I want to ask you about baseball a little bit. I found this stuff about kind of the origin story, or the desire to have an origin story around baseball, fascinating. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that ties into our religious tendencies?
Sure. I mean, one of the characteristics of religion is myth. And I'm not saying that as a way to dismiss faith by any stretch of the imagination. I'm a person of faith myself. But a myth is an important part of religion. And with baseball, you have the Cooperstown myth. And of course, everybody is familiar with this story, or most people at least, that Abner Doubleday sat down on a street corner in Cooperstown, New York, and mapped out the game of baseball. And that was played that afternoon in Elihu Finney's cow pasture in Cooperstown, New York. It's a wonderful story. It emphasizes the rural sort of bucolic origins of baseball, but it's just, it's a myth. Abner Doubleday actually was a cadet at West Point when he supposedly invented baseball at Cooperstown, New York. And the person who was responsible for this story was actually 5 years old at the time. And it just has no historical backing. But nevertheless, it's an important myth because it tells us something about what baseball was supposed to represent. That is this rural sort of bucolic game that was fashioned, again, during the Industrial Revolution. And what's striking me about baseball is if you fly into any major city, New York, Atlanta, wherever it may be, you fly over all of these buildings and these concrete canyons, but then you also see these islands of green in the middle of them. They are parks very often, but very often they're also baseball fields. And so baseball really tries to stand against industrialism, not only in the rejection of a clock, as we talked about earlier, but also because it maintains the kind of grassy green fields that we associate with rural life rather than urban life. So the mythology surrounding baseball is important, I think, for baseball's sort of self-understanding, but it's not the historical origin of the game.
I'm wondering, as you're saying that, you know, how baseball is really a response to industrialism. And now that we're moving into, I wonder if it no longer holds up in what is, you know, becoming the post-industrial age, the technological age. Is that, do you think that's a kind of an issue with the game right now, a cause for some lack of interest?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're living in a society that values time, well, at least in a surface sort of way, and baseball really aspires to be timeless, right? The passage of time is not supposed to be important to the game of baseball. And we're living in an age when people are very conscious about time. They want to be on time. You know, they don't have time to wait for anything. You know, everything is instantaneous. And so baseball, I think, is facing a real crisis. Now, Major League Baseball, as you know, for next season has decided to adopt a pitching clock and other reforms that are meant to improve the game and try to speed along the pace of the games. But in some ways, I certainly favor that because I think, you know, these pitching changes are much too long, for example. And I think the real problem is the players kind of preening for the television cameras by stepping out of the batter's box or stepping off the pitching mound and so forth. That's my own sort of layman's understanding of the problem. But yes, you're absolutely right. Baseball is facing a crisis because it has not been able to manage time in the way that the other sports have done.
Right. So you talked a little bit about you know, how football is an outgrowth of the Civil War, and of course the comparisons between football and battle. And, you know, obviously people have always enjoyed watching violent competition, going back to the gladiators in ancient Rome. For many years in this country, boxing was the preeminent violent sport. Is there something within our nature that craves that type of action? Do we as a society need a violent sport as a diversion?
Yeah, I wonder. What's striking to me about American society is that it is a violent society. We see that, of course, in the daily news. We see it with these terrible mass shootings. We see it with our history. You can look back into our history. The Indian Wars, the so-called Indian Wars of the 19th century, Manifest Destiny, pressing to the West Coast and then displacing or eliminating Native Americans along the way. We are a violent society. There's something about Americans who loves violence. And I hesitate to say that, but I think it's really true. And there's something about the violence of football, or for Canadians, the violence of hockey, that is attractive to to us as North Americans. Now, I think the difference between hockey and football in terms of violence is that in hockey, again, at the professional level, you have these violent eruptions. But what's different about football is that violence is scripted into the game itself. So it's a fundamental part of football to be violent, and it's just the nature of things. But I think there's something about American society that gravitates to violence. I teach a course here at Dartmouth called Sports, Ethics, and Religion. We had a discussion the other day about whether football is America's game. And I think the consensus on the part of the students, and it probably is my conclusion as well, is that there's something about American society with our love of violence that makes it likely that we would be attracted to a game like football. Now, you can argue, and I think there is an argument for this, that the violence that is enacted on the football field can be a sort of proxy for violence in the larger society, in the sense that perhaps in some way it sort of mitigates the violence we might otherwise see on the streets or elsewhere in our society, because we have the vicarious experience of violence on the football field. I suppose there's an argument for that, and I think there's probably some basis for saying that sort of thing. But nevertheless, we are a violent society. I'll just give you a quick anecdote from my personal experience. Some years ago, I was working on a PBS documentary with a director from Britain, and so we spent a lot of time together, and over the course of really a couple of years. And at one time, he told me that he was really considering coming to America, that is, moving to the United States, and he thought it over very carefully, especially during the time he was here in the U.S., and he decided finally he could not do it because America, he said, was too violent a place, too violent a society. So I think it's in some ways part of our DNA, which may be part of the reason that we're drawn to the game of football. And I have to say, I'll confess, I'm drawn to the game of football myself, so I'm not trying to talk about other people. I'm talking about myself as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, I've been a big football fan my whole life, and I've found myself in, the last 10 years or so involved in a kind of personal moral dilemma in following the game. As I've seen,
yes,
so many, there have been so many reports about the concussions, and I've seen so many features and read about so many of the players that I loved watching as a kid and a young man, and the way they've struggled with due to CTE, yes, CTE, the repeated concussions. You talk in the book a little bit about people wanting to ban the game in, late 19th, early 20th century. There were schools that did ban it for periods of time. Is there any type, to your knowledge, is there any type of movement within the religious community today to ban football?
I'm not aware of any. I'm not. I think it's, you know, it's just too big a lift. That is the, it's far too popular a game. But yes, you're absolutely right. In the early days of football, and it was even more brutal then than it is now, obviously because of lack of protective gear, and the rules were different as well. You could strike an opposing player three times with a closed fist before you were ejected from the game in the early days of football. And almost every account I read of 19th century football game included the word brutal or brutality in the description of the game. It was that violent. And, you know, again, as you know from the book, various schools, even the town of New Haven, outlawed football for a time. But again, it was just too popular and it came back. But no, I'm not aware of any religious group trying to eliminate football. I think the pushback would be far too great. You know, we talk about the difficulty in outlawing AR-15s or something like that. If anybody tried to outlaw football, I think there'd probably be even a greater reaction.
Yeah, I think that'd be a losing battle. Moving on to hockey, you're actually, the chapter on hockey in the book is called Soul of a Nation. That nation, of course, being Canada. How did hockey become so intertwined with the Canadian identity?
It's a fascinating story. And I have to say, in writing the book, hockey is the game I knew least about. And frankly, the game that I followed even less closely than the other games, although I do follow them at least from afar. I learned a lot in playing, in writing about hockey. Hockey, of course, was directly descended from the game of lacrosse. And what's fascinating about lacrosse and Canada is that lacrosse claimed to be Canada's game the same year, 1867, as the Canadian Confederation. That is the year that Canada effectively became an independent entity from Great Britain. And there was a dentist in Montreal by the name of George Beers, who was fascinated with the game of hockey, which, of course, is a Native American game. And he would go watch the Native Americans play lacrosse, or what they called Bagataway, outside Montreal. And he described the games that he was watching as, first of all, a game with no boundary, or playing field with no boundary. And he said 1,000 players on a team, which is probably an exaggeration, but nevertheless, it was really a mob game. And he was nevertheless fascinated with the game, and he decided that the game of hockey needed to be regularized. And so he was a Presbyterian, and as you may know, the kind of the watch phrase for Presbyterians is that they need to do everything decently and in order. And so what he tried to do was to bring order to the game of lacrosse by providing boundaries, that is, a constricted playing area, and also provided rules and limited the number of players on each side. And he, at the same time, in 1867, he makes this case that lacrosse should be Canada's game, that Canadians should reject cricket because it's a British game and it's too refined, it's too middle class, too prissy. He didn't use that word, but that's what he was talking about, in favor of a rough and tumble game that reflected the great expanses of the Canadian wilderness. And then, of course, as lacrosse evolves into ice hockey, it becomes even more Canadian in the sense that it really incorporates the frozen wilderness of the Canadian North. So hockey is a game that is really tied with Canadian identity. I talk about the 1972 Summit Series between Canadian professionals and Soviet Union hockey players who were amateurs. And Canada, of course, went into that series thinking, well, this is our game, hockey, and you know, we're going to dispatch these Soviets rather easily. Well, it didn't turn out that way. The Soviets won the first game, which was a real blow to Canadian identity. And then the series shifted eventually to Moscow. And in the eighth game, in a tied series, this is the game that was going to decide the series, it wasn't until 34 seconds left that Paul Henderson finally scored a goal for the Canada team. And all of Canada just kind of erupted in elation at that moment. I have a friend, a former student actually, who talks about that. He said, just as Americans remember where they were when, you know, for us older generation, when John Kennedy was shot, for example, or when news of the Challenger disaster or 9/11 came across the airwaves, Canadians remember where they were in 1972 when the Canadians finally won the Summit Series. And once again, hockey was Canada's game.
Yeah. You know, you talk a little bit about how popular hockey night in Canada is. And, you know, I think to a lesser extent in this country, certainly at one time, I think Monday Night Football had that kind of following. Mm-hmm. Do you view those events as, in a way, replacing or at least supplementing Sunday morning church?
I think they have. I think, and if you look at the statistics, the level of religious adherence in North America, both Canada and the United States, has gone down over the last several decades. We in the United States are still a religious nation. There's no question about that. But there's also no question that the level of religious adherence has gone down rather dramatically over the last several decades. At the same time, you have increased interest and passion and affiliation with sports. And I think in many ways, the loyalties of many Americans, that is both Canadians and people in the United States, have shifted from the sanctuary to the stadium, which of course is another sort of variant in sacred space. The stadium, particularly these older stadiums, Fenway Park or Lambeau Field or Wrigley Field, are sacred space to a lot of fans, much the way that religion was once a sacred space for a lot of people.
Yeah, moving on to basketball, you talk in the book, of course, about how religious institutions, or perhaps most notably the YMCAs, had a big impact on the spread of the game of basketball. Was that just a result of Dr. Naismith's, own history in divinity and his inclinations, or is there a reason that YMCAs kind of gravitated to basketball in particular?
Well, I think it, in large measure because basketball was invented at the YMCA up in Springfield, Massachusetts, but also the spread of basketball is due, I think, largely to the fact that it was the graduates of these YMCA schools, particularly what is now Springfield College, as they began to fan out across North America and eventually to the world, starting or becoming directors of local YMCAs, they brought basketball with them. But the other factor in the emergence or the spread of basketball is the fact that Naismith wanted a game that could be played with very, very little equipment. So all you needed was a basketball hoop and a ball. Of course, originally it was a peach basket, but later it evolved into a basketball hoop. And you could play the game of basketball almost anywhere. And of course, you have it now rather predominantly in urban spaces and asphalt playgrounds with basketball hoops and so forth. But also it's played in Indian reservations and, out in mission fields. Missionaries brought basketball to various places all around the world. And so it began to spread all over the world. And that was one of the fondest hopes that Naismith had for the game of basketball. And he was able to see that during his lifetime.
And of course, you were just talking about, with the sacred spaces involved with baseball, Lambeau Field. I think we tend to associate that more so with baseball. I think something about you talk about in the book, the the pastoral nature of it and the green open field, and often in the middle of an urban setting, there's something kind of majestic about that. Does that sense of sacred space apply to basketball, which, as you noted, is, of course, very much an urban game?
Yeah, I think it does. It's probably more particular for a team's fans than it would be for all fans sort of indiscriminately. But, for example, we've got you have people who are very devoted to Madison Square Garden, for example, or the old Boston Garden where the Celtics played with the parquet floor and all that stuff. That was very important to certainly Celtics fans, but also other basketball fans. Part of the problem is that there's the number of arenas going up all the time and new stadiums is so rapid, so fevered in many ways, that fans don't have time to kind of connect with the history of a particular place the way they do with Wrigley Field, for example, or Fenway Park, or, you know, the big house in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They don't have the same sort of historical resonances that the older places do.
Yeah, and as you're answering that, I'm thinking, you know, in basketball, to some extent, those sacred places have become kind of inner city pickup type places, like a Rucker Park in New York, or for some people, even just the park in their neighborhood community that they grew up playing on. There's something I think about, like you said, the urban nature of the game and the fact that you can, the wonderful thing about basketball is, you know, as you said, all you need is a basket and a ball and you can play it by yourself. So you can, I think a lot of people, and sometimes even within communities, that mythology around the game is created within a local park more so than even the Madison Square Gardens of the world.
That's right. Yeah, and that's a very good point. And I do point out that, you know, in places like New York or Chicago, you know, we have these local legends who never made it to the college level or let alone to the pro level, who are still sort of spoken of in hushed and reverent tones in these various neighborhoods and communities.
Right. We can't talk about the religious symbolism in sports without discussing the collision between sports and politics. How do the religious roots of sports play into people's reactions to, for example, the Colin Kaepernick situation where he took a knee on the field, or even going back many years to the desegregation of various sports? How do the religious roots play into that?
Well, certainly religious folks, you know, very often were pushing for that sort of integration, particularly Jewish sports writers, by the way, with the integration of baseball. That was a very important element of that desegregation. But one of the things I observe in the book is that we live in a society where we once took moral direction from religious leaders, people like Walter Rauschenbusch, who's the associated with the social gospel movement at the turn of the 20th century, for example, or Dorothy Day, or Thomas Merton, or Abraham Joshua Heschel in Judaism, or Reinhold Niebuhr, Martin Luther King Jr. I think more often than not these days, we get our moral direction from sports figures. And Colin Kaepernick, I think, is one example of that. Recently, LeBron James and other athletes have talked about the persistence of racism in American society. And I think in many ways, we're now looking to the arena of sports for our moral authority. Now, I think that says something probably not all that healthy about our society, or at least the state of religion in our society. But I think it's nevertheless the case that that's where we find our moral direction these days.
We've talked a lot about the religious symbolism in various sports, and some of it is fairly obvious to, you know, any observer, the devotion to team, the rituals, the deification of certain athletes. And you talk about other examples in the book. Is there something in human nature that gravitates to that religious or devotional mindset?
I think there probably is. I'm not really an expert on that sort of thing, but yes, I think what both religion and sports have in common is that at their best, at least, they take us out of ourselves. They take us out of our ordinary, everyday, quotidian lives and take us to another level. You know, those of us who are people of faith can talk about moments of spiritual uplifting or even ecstasy, much the way that I think a sports fan would take would have an appreciation for the athleticism and the artistry of Michael Jordan or Matthew Stafford. They understand the grace and they appreciate the grace and the athleticism of these individuals who can perform at a level that most of us can never aspire to, and that kind of lifts us. It's a euphoric moment that is not all that different from what people of faith sometimes experience in their religious context.
You talked before about how, you know, even though the number of people in this country who believe in God or associate with organized religion has declined, appears to continue to decline, that we are still a religious country. Have you examined all the influence of religion on sports in other countries as compared to the United States? I know we talked about Canada a little bit, but
yeah, just Canada. Yeah, no, there's certainly, I mean, the World Cup, of course, is something that is very important to people all around the world with the soccer championship, and there's a lot of passion surrounding that as well. But I haven't really looked at that. No, I'm an American historian, so right. I kept my focus there.
Okay, Randall, I think it's been a pleasure talking to you about the book. I'll get you out of here with one last question that I like to ask all my guests. But first, once again, let me say the name of Randall's book is Passion Play. Passion Plays, How Religion Shapes Sports in North America. It really, you know, as I told Randall before we came on the air, it really kind of, I'm a longtime sports fan, obviously, and it forced me to look at the games that I love in different ways. And that's, you know, that doesn't happen to me very often. That's a cool thing. So
I'm delighted to hear that. That's great.
And, you know, so anytime a book can open your mind or show you new perspectives, that's a good thing. So Randall, let me ask you this final question. What is your all-time favorite sports book?
Oh my goodness. Wow. Oh, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I read it as a child. The Glory of Their Times. It's a wonderful book about baseball in some of its early years, and it's been decades since I read the book, but I love that book. Yeah, it's very good.
All right. Well, Randall, thanks again for coming on and talking about the book. I wish you best of luck with it.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate the conversation. Great questions. Thank you.